Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast, episode 106, the one about Natalie Dormer's Oxford Q&A, remote work tools and the film Gladiator. Let's get on with the show.
Well, hello and welcome to another recording of Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast. We are back with more news, tech content and wisdom from the world of marketing. Joining me, a man on a mission, a marketing speaker and consultant who spent his whole career helping his customers keep their marketing simple but effective, is the author of Cat's Mat and Marketing Plans and the creator of the Roger Vlog video series. I give you Mr. Roger Edwards.
Oh, thank you so much. And of course, my co-host is a digital marketing veteran. He's a speaker, trainer and advisor with nearly three decades of experience. He enjoys revealing visual storytelling techniques to help you build online campaigns faster. I give you all the way from La France, Monsieur Pascal Fintoni.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. This remains an international production, and thank you to your lovely audience. This is Roger, episode 106.
Absolutely. 106. We seem to be flying through the low hundreds now, don't we? We're definitely on a roll.
We are, and this is lovely because we're getting some great reaction on social media, but also we've got some new YouTube subscribers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so according to the dashboard, we've got an extra 19 subscribers in the month of August. I've got some names here for you to say hello to, so we're going to say hello and thank you to the Drive-By Nerve. What a wonderful name. Hello to Nasib PT. Tranquil Rabies, MudCrunch 6955, Caleb McNear, and Jason Hubler. We also, Roger, got some lovely comments because we've been publishing the film marketing reviews as standalone extracts on the channel. So we've got some lovely reaction for the interview with the vampire from Raph Rees, but also got two suggestions for future film marketing reviews. So Luke Bishop is suggesting that there is a TV series, which I've not seen yet, for the interview with the vampire. And they're suggesting that this TV series should get more of a following. It should be, you know, more known, but maybe the marketing campaign let it down. So a suggestion from Luke Bishop. And finally, from Marchand, I'm going to say that this is a French word, Marchand 12, who reacted to the Tomorrow War film marketing review we did about a year ago, saying this is a great movie, but look into Live, Die, Repeat. Remember that one with Tom Cruise?
That was one of those time loop films, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where it went round and round. Having said that, maybe it was marketed in this country under a different name, because I don't remember it being called that. It was something like The Edge of Tomorrow or the.
It was indeed. So
end
they kept
of
flipping
or something.
The Edge of Tomorrow, you're right. They kept flipping between the two, which was very confusing. So
yeah,
a suggestion from him, but also what a lovely comment saying, by the way, I think the concept of your channel is great. I never would have put much thought into marketing reviews. This is not my business, but you guys are doing an amazing job. So thank you to Marchand 12.
Fantastic. It's really good to get comments like that, isn't it, Pascal?
No, absolutely. Because like I said in my reply to him, so, well, we put a lot of work in the research. We put a lot of work in the show notes, the creation, the deliberation and research beforehand. So it's nice that others are noticing. That's really nice. On the subject of research, Roger, it was your turn to choose a film for film and marketing.
Indeed. And we are going to review today the film and the marketing of the film, which some people, Pascal, reckon is one of the greatest movies ever made, or at least one of the greatest action movies ever made. And that film is Gladiator.
My goodness. Do you know what? Very recently, I added Gladiator on the watch list on Amazon Prime because I want to get back to it. Can't wait to talk about this. If memory serves, this was released in the year 2000.
Yep, so it's 23 years old already.
My goodness, nearly a quarter of a century. But listen, before we get into film marketing and your selection, we've got a few segments to go through to give you lots of advice and to stimulate your imagination as a marketer. And we're going to begin with In the News.
The European Union's Digital Services Act, the DSA, came into force on the 25th of August, a milestone moment in regulating internet giants, and it is designed to keep users safe online and stop the spread of harmful content.
Well, listen to this, Roger. Snapchat could be making a comeback. It is so far the fastest growing social media platform, with a 13.4% user growth this year, thanks to features like Stories, Spectacles, Spotlight, Voice Filters, and Bitmoji TV.
According to Bizarre Voice, 61% of consumers have followed a recommendation from friends or family, while just 19% say they have made a purchase based on an endorsement from a celebrity influencer.
Well, a survey from HubSpot has revealed that while almost 9 in 10 marketing managers see AI as being effective, almost half also perceive a technology skills gap within their teams.
A quarter of consumers are worried that AI will negatively impact their shopping experiences, while 91% say they'd rather interact with humans than AI, according to SAP Emarsys.
Hotels.com has hired British film director Edgar Wright to direct a series of TV adverts promoting their new mobile app to the tune of the Humans League, Don't You Want Me?
Lollipop brand Chupa Chups is making its first entry into the online game platform by launching Chupa Chups Skate and Create in partnership with Roblox.
One other partnership, Heineken Brazil and Lupa Brazil, have designed a functioning gaming PC that doubles as a fridge to keep your beers cold as part of Heineken's Not All Night Out Are Out.
Goodness me, Chupa Chups Skate and Create, that's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It is a bit. Now, I want to begin actually with the last two bit of news that we've covered, this partnership between the consumer brand and, let's say, tech, although granted, a fridge gaming PC combo is kind of interesting, because I'm seeing more and more now some very, very clear targeting and some very clear allocation of where a brand and what a brand stands for and who they're going to partner with. So, for example, I'm noticing, thanks to you, as I'm spending more and more time on Fortnite, that Fortnite has become the domain for entertainment. You know, I saw, for example, shout out for Ahsoka, you know, the new Disney Plus TV series. Roblox seems to do a lot with consumer brands. We did a news some months ago about DIY shops as well. And we have Heineken, which is also linked to a love entertainment, because Heineken is seen often in the world of movies. And here they are with gamers and PC gamers. It's interesting, isn't it?
I did wonder when you started saying this, is it the case that maybe tech brands aren't as good at marketing communications as, say, fast-moving consumer goods companies are, like Heineken and Chupa Chups, and therefore it makes sense that they get into partnership with a FMCG company because they can effectively benefit from that better marketing skill set? But then I thought about it a bit more and thought, well, actually, no, there's a lot of tech people out there doing really good marketing, like the aforementioned Fortnite that you've just mentioned there. So maybe that isn't the case. But yeah, it is interesting. I've noticed it myself that there are a lot more of these tech brands teaming up with FMCG companies to do joint marketing campaigns.
Yeah, and I think, therefore, it's obviously working well for them, in spite of the logic of where is your audience. And if your audience, and I think Chupa Chups, I mean, obviously, this is taken back to my youth. So for some reason, they're associated with the summer season, where you know, you learn literally to dissect, you know, the color coding of the wrapper around the top of that, you know, that sweet, you know, because I was always looking for the Coca-Cola flavor, which is always so delightful. So I think you've got a younger audience who's going to want the lollipop, I'm guessing. And certainly that demographic is on Roblox actually quite a bit from what I can gather. And vice versa, those who are drinking beer needs to be 18 and over. Of course they are. And playing games on and their PC, and if you take the trouble, viewers and listeners, to look for the photo of that PC, it's a computer that doubles as a fridge. It looks exquisite. Although I suppose for you and I, would be more a wine bar that we would want than yes, a fridge, of course. I want to take you all the way just to kind of mention to our viewers and listeners that we will be doing a special in October about the Digital Services Act. It's a biggie. Not only is it impacting the internet giant, but actually it is impacting anyone with an online presence. So let's be very careful here. Whilst the headline is all about, you know, giving Facebook, Twitter, and all the others a bit of a hard time about, I would say, to my view, how negligent they've been or laissez-faire they've been with harmful content, it is going to be true of anyone with an online presence, and anyone certainly with contacts, Roger, in the EU. There is a similar version in the UK. So we'll come back to that one certainly in October. But I wanted to ask, I suppose, you know, it was only something that was inevitable that people are going to say, do you know what, those celebrity influencers, I don't really have much respect for them. I much prefer to listen to my friends and family.
Now, it's absolutely obvious that this is the case. You know, we've had this chat on the show quite a few times. Influencers have been overhyped, haven't they? Like anywhere, there's always going to be some people out there who do a good job, and it's worth having them endorse your product or your service. But some of them, they're just not good enough. They haven't really got the gravitas or the chops to actually do it. So undoubtedly, people will listen to their friends and family. Having said that, I suppose there's a counter argument as well to that, isn't there? Because I do think that we tend to live in a bit of an echo chamber these days. And, you know, Auntie Doreen down the road or Uncle Tom from up the road, he might have an opinion on the vaccines and he might have an opinion on how COVID spreads. And, you know, we shouldn't maybe always listen to what our friends and family say about some important things. But yeah, on the whole, definitely better to listen to them about consumer goods and services rather than influencers, I would reckon.
But, you know, that's interesting because the friends and family recommendation, as, you know, as part of, like, the thinking of marketers and business owners, this has been true since, you know, people have been trading, you know, in local marketplaces in the Middle Ages. And therefore, for me, it's back to this idea of, you know, there is temptation to always look for the new shiny object, looking for the new hack or the new trick or the new tip. But actually, there are, you know, some constant in the world of marketing. But I get it, you know, it's not as exciting to keep going on about the same old marketing rules and principles from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
They do work.
Yeah.
And absolutely. If in your strategy you don't think about friends and family, but you've put all your money and all your effort in trying to court influencers, you'd be actually doing a complete 360 and making a complete fool of yourself in the office. Is that a bit blunt, Roger?
No, it's absolutely spot on. It's absolutely spot on. You've got to know your customer. And, you know, it's a simple question. Ask your customers, do you listen to influencers? And if the answer's no, then don't spend your money on influencers. It's as simple as that.
Talking about decisions you have to make in the office and beyond, I read out this survey from HubSpot saying that, you know, in general, you know, marketers believe that AI can help you be more effective, 98%, but that there is obviously a skill gap within the team. What I find interesting is that this skill gap, you and I have reported this as early as we've started, you know, a 2 Geeks in Marketing podcast 3 years ago, whereby, you know, training and development is not sufficient in most organizations. Indeed, you know, even if you're working on your own. So my reaction to that is, not, it's not an AI skill gap that is slowing people down. It's a general skill gap on strategy, a skill gap on reporting, on measuring, but also on creativity. And then you can have the technology to support you. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I agree. We seem to be over the first wave of hysteria about things like AI, ChatGPT, don't we? I don't see it as much as I did 6 months ago. Although there are still some of these people out there peddling these $97 courses for all the prompts, this, that, and the other. And there'll always be some marketers out there who basically put our profession to shame by jumping on the latest bandwagon and trying to convince people that they can build 6, 7, 8, 9-figure businesses by investing in a $97 course to give them a few prompts to use ChatGPT. I think that we're starting to settle down into that feeling that it's a tool now. And yes, you know, I've used it a few times. I still don't think it's as brilliant as a lot of the hype made out it was, but it can give you some interesting ideas for prompts. It does a pretty good job at coming up with titles for YouTube videos. It does a pretty good job of maybe polishing something that you've already written. So you could put something into ChatGPT and say, here's an article I've written, just make it a little bit more engaging. And it does a pretty good job of doing that. But I've done the majority of the work already, and I'm using this as a tool to give something a polish. I think that we should never get to that stage where the hype was a few months ago, where let's just give it everything to do. And that was when I felt that our marketing profession was in danger of just giving it away its creativity and giving away its humanity. And I think that we're back to where we should be now. But that's a long way of saying I agree with what you say. I think that the problem is a lot of companies don't train their staff. And if you've got a staff member who is going to effectively self-train, they'll go out there and they'll have this journey of experience just like we have in this journey of discovery. But I do think that a lot of companies, and yeah, okay, we're in tough times, so budgets get cut and training budgets are often the same casualty as the marketing budget. So I think that we should never forget the importance of training our staff, especially in a world that's moving so fast.
No, thank you very much. And on the subject of creativity, let's finish then with this business of hotels.com using the talented Edgar Wright. I'm thinking, of course, Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver and Hot Fuzz and all that, for their kind of very short, sharp, you know, the unique style of editing and storytelling, but also combining this with the Human League's Don't You Want Me? And the other being that this mobile app from hotels.com allows you to compare different hotels. And of course, some will be disappointed. And it's actually quite interesting, you know, the way they've done it. Isn't that fascinating, really, that you know, here we are, people who are trying to find ways to let a machine make the decision on what to do. And then people say, no, no, we're going to go to where the talents are.
Yeah, no, I love Edgar Wright. The films you've mentioned are fantastic. I also really enjoyed the Sparks Brothers documentary he did about the band Sparks, which of course is another musical segue into Human League. That, I mean, Don't You Want We was a gigantic hit back in the 80s. It was one of the biggest hits at the time, I remember, and it's one of those songs that pretty much everybody knows, no matter how old they are. So this makes absolute sense to me.
No, and honestly, it's delightful. You can look for them on YouTube and see the work, both in terms of the visual storytelling, but the way in which they've combined, you know, the words of the song. It's just, you know, what TV adverts should be all about. Now, listen, always a pleasure to get your reaction and views on recent news, but let's slow things down with our next segment, the Content Spotlights. Now, in this segment of the show, we choose a piece of content, an article, a podcast, a video, an infographic, something that can help us reflect what it means to be a content creator and marketer in today's economy. So, Roger, what is your selection for episode 106?
Well, this is a bit of a different one, Pascal. You know, spend quite a lot of time on YouTube, and I just sort of came across this video. It was suggested to me in my feed. It's probably not the sort of video I would have naturally gone looking for or even thought about, but it's one of these Oxford Union Q&A videos. Now, these are actually quite popular, and the actual Oxford Union YouTube channel has 1.83 million subscribers. So I've got a hell of a long way to go to catch up with them. So these videos are obviously very popular, but this is an interview in the Oxford Union with the actress Natalie Dormer. Now, for those of you who don't know, Natalie Dormer was in Game of Thrones. She played Marjorie Tyrell in Game of Thrones. And also, for people who are fans of historical drama, she also played Anne Boleyn in The Tudors, which is going back about a decade now. But she was very good as Anne Boleyn in The Tudors. And I thought, oh, I'll just watch the introduction to this. And then about an hour and 15 minutes later, I sort of raised my head and thought, wow, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. First of all, incredibly engaging actress. And obviously, when you watch a film, you see them portraying the part. So Marjorie Tyrell, Anne Boleyn, etc. This was a real revelation about the actor herself and her actual personality. Very engaging personality, incredible storyteller. She tells quite a lot of stories throughout the interview. And it's worth watching just for her storytelling technique, Pascal. She's just really, really engaging. And you can see in the video from the reaction shots from the audience, they're all leaning forward, really engaged in what she's actually saying. And as you would expect, lots of stories from the production of things like The Tudors and from the production of Game of Thrones, and lots of insights into the production process and the writing process and how they might change dialogue and, you know, things that you never really think about. It reminded me a lot, actually, of our interview with my sister Kate back in episode 100, those sort of insider snippets that you get about Hollywood that you probably didn't really know. But the thing that fascinated me the most was this conversation they had about what a complete utter balls up the ending of Game of Thrones became, and her opinions on that, having been in the show. It was absolutely fascinating. And of course, as a bit of background, everybody knows Game of Thrones, one of the biggest shows ever made on TV, 8 series. And it was is based upon a series of books by George R. Martin. And the problem is he hasn't actually finished the series of books yet. And eventually the TV series overtook where he got to in the books. So the creators of the show had to invent the ending. Now, undoubtedly, they had a lot of guidance from George R. Martin, but he hasn't actually written the books yet. So they haven't got any dialogue to base those final series on. And I think the general opinion across fandom, across the world, was that the ending of Game of Thrones was just really bad compared to how incredible the build-up had been over the previous series. And she goes into quite a lot of detail on this. And rather than be critical, although she does admit that it was a bit of a fiasco having been in it, but rather than being critical, she actually almost threw it back to the interview and threw it back to the audience and said, well, what would you have done yourself? And then she said, what would happen if somebody gave you Lord of the Rings by Tolkien, the whole series of books, put them down in front of you, and you've never read them before, and then they went and chopped out the final quarter of Lord of the Rings? Do you think that anybody in this room or any scriptwriter in the world would be able to create the ending of Lord of the Rings as Tolkien did without any without knowing what the story was so far? And she said, I would guarantee that everybody would come up with something inferior to what Tolkien ended up writing. And she says, that's exactly what's happened with Game of Thrones. The books were there, and they were, and the first few series were based upon the books, and therefore a lot of the dialogue was reflected in the actual script itself. But when you get to that final quarter that's missing, nobody in the world will be able to create something that's going to satisfy everybody, that's going to be as visionary as George R. R. Martin's actual ending will be if he ever gets around to writing it. And it just made me think, that is so, you know, it was so insightful, a way of portraying that by saying, compare it to Lord of the Rings and think about what would happen if you didn't know the ending. Could you actually write the ending yourself, having not known any previous knowledge? And it just made me think a lot. But again, maybe one of the things that we make mistakes about in our marketing careers is that sometimes we haven't got the end in sight. We tend to spend a lot of time on short-term things, fighting fires today, tactical things. But you and I keep coming back to this strategic thing. And what is the ending? What would the last quarter of your story be if you were to write it now? And I think a lot of us don't. And that's possibly why we end up stuffing up the ending, or we never get to where we think we wanted to get to. And all this interview just made me think of all sorts of things like that, both strategically, both from a filmmaking point of view, from a TV point of view, from a storytelling point of view. So my recommendation is to, when you finish listening to this, and do listen to the rest of the show and watch the rest of the show, then go and luxuriate in Natalie Dormer's interview, because it really is worth it.
This is just amazing. And somehow we managed to, you know, include a reference to films now, from the introduction to the in the news to the content spotlights as well. Thank you very much, Roger. But do you know, these Q&As from Oxford Union, they are just outstanding. There are so many, you can just pick and choose what you like. But what they've done very well is the convergence of business and academia and entertainment. I mean, some of the actors and film directors have had, for the Q&A, as well as business. you know, entrepreneurs is quite something. And you're right, every conversation is just so good. I mean, incredibly, the Oxford Union, as this environment for debate and discussion, is celebrating its bicentenary this year, only because I follow their channel, mostly Aysen Thread for film directors and actors and actresses, but you know the interviews are always very, very good. And I think you're right, it's very conversational. However, each of the speakers and guests, you know, they bring something very unique. So you're right, it's multi, you can get values from so many different levels listening to this one. But what's interesting as well is you could argue that Natalie Dormer is not the most famous of the actresses who's been on Game of Thrones. And yet, when you listen to our interview, it's not as if, you know, she's got nothing to bring to the discussion.
No, I mean, yeah, the part she played was relatively small. She didn't have many scenes, but it was quite a pivotal theme that was running through. And I mean, she was killed in series 5, I think, in a big explosion at the Sept of Baelor. But the implications of some of the things that she did in the script actually played out still in the seasons that followed. Her mother was still alive and her mother was still plotting and this, that, and the other. So yeah, no, absolutely fascinating individual to listen to. And I would definitely look for more stuff that she's, I mean, if she was to do a podcast, I would definitely listen to it.
Yeah, smashing. So my selection this week actually was sent to me. This was an email that I received from Beverly Sherritt and Joe Cameron, the founders of Launchpad Associates. If you don't know them, they are exceptional advisors, consultants in the world of HR, leadership, and career development. And I received this email, and the title was intriguing to me. It goes as follows: 5 remote work tools to support company culture. Now, here's the thing. Typically, back to actually the in the news segment, when you talk about tools and apps and so on, the next thing is about being productive, Roger, it's about being creative and so on. But I thought, supporting company culture. And indeed, when you look at the subtitle of this article, can you create company culture in a company without a physical office? ? So you've got the title, 5 remote work tools to support company culture. And then the question is it possible to achieve the same degree of togetherness and sense of belonging and actually understanding the values of an organization if you don't have a physical office? And this is, of course, addressing the needs and wants of team leaders and managers, but also the workers. The context that they share, this great article that I recommend people to read because it's got stats, it's got quotes from experts as well as their recommendation, suggests that, you know, according to Glassdoor, up to 77% of job seekers now are wondering about the culture of an organization, just as much as, you know, the job details and the salaries and so on, making sure that this is a right move for them, literally. And the prediction is that by the end of next year, you know, we could see up to 45% of people working remotely, or as the term goes, hybrid. So this is a challenge, and we have seen in the headlines, I'm sure you have as well, big brands like Amazon and Google saying, no, you must go back to the office. And it's kind of a weird statement to have, because I think that if anything, we've proven that it can work to, on occasion, work remotely. And I think it's kind of where it is it that management is saying, we just don't know how to do this, perhaps, is a point that Beverly and Joe are mentioning. So the article is split into 5 categories of tools that can support essentially company culture: project management tools, communication tools, calendars and scheduling, collaboration. But the final one is very important: recognition tools. So how do you keep track of someone's contribution, someone's also alignment to your company culture and values, and how do you find ways for them to be rewarded, even if it's just an accolade during a monthly meeting and so on? And so this article, you can read this in one go, but you'll find yourself going back to it. But this is one of those where literally back in the days of fax machine, you could see yourself faxing this to your boss and your other colleagues saying, here's an interesting debate for us to have, because ultimately, if we want to attract the best talent in our industry, we're going to have to do things a little differently. We're going to have to learn to manage things people particularly differently. They're not going to be in the office Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, where we can just hover and pick up essentially good contribution to work, as well as time where they might need some support and some guidance. We've got tools now that can help us do that. But what is interesting for me is back to, it's not just productivity, it's not just creativity, it's actually supporting and adding to company culture. And by the way, as marketers, if we don't understand company culture, our work is made so much harder as well.
Yeah, no, this is really good stuff. And yeah, I've seen this. A lot of my friends that are still working in big corporate, there is a bit more of pressure on them to get back into the office. And my view on this is that it's more of a command and control thing than it is about reality. I think there are just that personality style of manager that just likes to have staff in the office so they can keep a beady eye on them, which means that they don't trust their staff to do the work. If you've got staff and you trust them and you give them good goals and good targets, then it shouldn't matter where they work. As long as they get the work done, that should be all you're worried about. Forcing them to go and sit in an office and commute 2 hours in each direction each day is just an ego thing, I've always thought. But this is really interesting. And I did have a skim through the article before we had this conversation. And it's really interesting. I think we could all benefit from these tools, Pascal.
No, completely. And I think for me, that back to the last one, which is so... close to what Berlin Joel believes in, that recognition. So that's the danger, isn't it? That as a manager, you will spot things in the office, granted, because of the chat during the coffee break, or just, you know, passing the time of day during the lunch and so on. So what are the ways in which you can still do that and catch those quite significant little elements in a way that, you know, means that when you have the review, when you have the discussion with your team, you can say, I know, I've spotted your contribution. I want to thank you, because, you know, saying thank you is just as important as other forms of rewards. So, yep, a very important article, but two fine selections again for the content spotlights. But I want to suggest, Roger, that we go back in time with our next segment, This Week in History.
In 1928, General Electric made the first simulcast with Schenectady, New York, broadcasting the play The Queen's Messenger over radio and TV at the same time.
Wow, but in 1969, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? By Anna Barbara debuted on CBS in the US and it aired for two seasons until the end of October in 1970.
In 1977, the Atari 2600, originally known as the Atari Video Computer System, Atari VCS, is released in North America, completely changing the video game industry.
Indeed, and in 1999, Sean Fanning and Sean Parker released a file-sharing service, Napster. The service provided a simple way for users to copy, illegally, and distribute MP3 music files.
Oh, I used to love Napster. In the days before iTunes and before digital downloads, you know, was a lot of us were on Napster getting our favorite albums downloaded.
So did you get a bit of a free song by being a digital criminal in those days?
People did say that the police were watching your download history, didn't they? And they said that you might knock on your door, or not even knock on your door, use one of those great big red enforcer things to beat your door down and come and arrest you at 5 in the morning. So yeah, I was a little bit worried about it, but we didn't half download a lot of stuff.
Don't want to be unkind about the police, but I can't imagine they had that capability in the 2000s. But yeah, we'd be quite dramatic. I mean, it would be even more dramatic. Imagine the FBI knocking your door down like in the movies.
Absolutely right. And going back to 1969, Scooby-Doo. Do you know one of the things that always amazes me about the series that Hanna-Barbera put out? So we've obviously got Scooby-Doo, which we're talking about. Other ones I can remember. Josie and the Pussycats, I can remember. Top Cat, or Boss Cat, as it was known in the UK. And there was It's the Wolf. There was Penelope Pit Stop. There was Wacky Races. Yeah. All these cartoons that a lot of us grew up with. The thing that staggers me is that most of them only ran for one or two seasons of maybe between 13 and 22 episodes. And we just must have kept watching the same ones over and over again, because they always seem to be on for years and years and years. And yet they only made one or two series. But for those of you who might get this as a pub quiz, quiz question. Apparently, the name Scooby-Doo originally came from a Frank Sinatra song, the song where he goes dooby dooby doo. They heard that and added the skr at the beginning, and there you go, Scooby Scooby Doo. But it was a cracking song as well, wasn't it? Scooby Scooby Doo, where are you? We've got some work to do now. Absolutely classic stuff.
The stories were absolutely compelling. You had literally an ensemble cast as well. You know, you liked all the characters with all little character traits and idiosyncrasies. Of course, Scooby-Doo was the star of the show. But what is interesting to your point is exactly my memory is that there was hundreds of those. Yes. In fact, there was only three seasons. So two seasons for CBS and one for ABC. And then you had some specials. And then, of course, more recently, they've done you know, a more recent way. But the drawings clearly are too neat. You know, you wanted a hand-drawn cartoon quality, and the kind of flow in the motion of the characters when they're walking or running and so on. When I was younger, I thought Hanna-Barbera was a person. I think her first name was Hannah and the second was Barbara. But you're right, you know, there was that and a few others. As soon as you saw the beginning, and it was almost like a brand, wasn't it? It was the brand Hanna-Barbera meant, I'm going to have a great time. Let's sit down and watch what was on occasion quite scary stories as well.
Yeah, no, yeah, I would have got away with it as well if it wasn't for you pesky kids.
So I've got a bit of a story to tell and a confession to make about the Atari 26100 or 2600 should be perhaps the best way to say it. So this has changed home gaming forever. I mean, people within 1977, it was this strange brown box with some very, very clunky levers and two controls, and you play a very crude version of tennis or you know, kind of Frogger and that kind of things. And people absolutely loved it, and we spent hours and hours playing, just as much as people playing now with modern one. So our neighbor had one, and we were allowed to go and play, but unfortunately, because we were far too young, we did not switch it off properly. And his Atari video computer system literally fried and burnt in the inside, the chip, whatever. And we killed his Atari system, which was really quite embarrassing, but also very, very expensive. I remember getting myself into real trouble with my dad, who reimbursed, you know, our friend and neighbor. But so this is, each time I see the Atari, I recognize their contribution to the world of gaming, because without Atari, there would be no PS5, there'd be no Xbox, there'd be none of the things that we're talking about. But I also have this anguish about the thought that I killed probably the first French Atari video computer system ever.
I can remember playing with those Ataris. I would have said it was later than 1977. I had it in my head it was more like 1980, but hey, history just melts into one, doesn't it?
That's why this segment is important, because you get it back in your head about the dates, you know, 1977, you know, I mean, even the first item you read, which was an accomplishment from a technology point of view, 1928, so give or take, you know, 100 years ago, people got together to try and find a way to broadcast at the same time on radio and TV the same show, which is now is a given. Of course, it is a given. You know, you can listen to radio, you can actually go online and watch, you know, the DJs in their booth and so on. But back then, it was quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always a pleasure to go down, you know, with you down memory lane. But let's get back into the present, if you don't mind, with our next segment, Marketing Tech and Apps. So, Roger, what incredible gems have we found in the world of tech and apps to make our life easier as a marketer and content creator?
Well, this week I absolutely had to find an app to help me out of a bit of a disaster that I had whilst out filming a vlog. So I was out this week trying to get a few videos done so that when I'm on holiday over the next 2 weeks in Tenerife, I can still actually put out a video as I usually do on a Saturday. And I went to a place in East Lothian, which is quite a famous location of a very famous battle dating back to the year 832. And it's in a lovely little village called Athelstaneford, Well, it's called Athelstaneford if you pronounce it the English way. If you live in Scotland, people will pronounce it differently. And they'll pronounce it as Aylshingford. And you'll look at the spelling, you'll think, how do you get Aylshingford from that? But anyway, that's a little bit of an aside. Anyway, I went to the village. I did my usual walk around. I'd researched some of the buildings, did this, that, and the other. And then the sort of the highlight of the video was me stood with it in this field where this battle took place, actually telling the story of this battle. And it was an absolutely gorgeous day. The sun was out, beautiful quality of video. And I was really happy, got back in the car, came home. And when I was reviewing the footage later, there was no sign of that pivotal storytelling bit on my HD card. Now, I knew it was there because I always check and have a quick listen or a quick watch of the clip to make sure that I haven't made it blurred or got the sound wrong or the framing wrong. But it wasn't there. And I think, how's that happened? Have I accidentally deleted it? I didn't remember accidentally deleting it, but then it would have been an accident. But anyway, so I thought, I'll have to go back and film it again. But of course, by the end, this time it was getting on, the light had changed and everything. So I started looking on Google for software that might be able to retrieve deleted files off my SD card. And I came across two. The first was called Stellar Data Recovery Professional, and the second one's called Wondershare Recover It. Now, I tried both of them. I started with Stellar Data Recovery Professional, and actually, I was quite amazed by how many files it managed to find on this SD card, some of which I deleted over 18 months ago, Pascal. Wow, so it definitely works. It definitely works. But there was no sign of this file that I'd actually recorded literally that afternoon. So I'd tried this other one, Wondershare Recover It, and indeed, Wondershare Recover It managed to find even more, which was staggering, but still no sign of this actual file. Now, Wondershare Recover It actually came up with pretty much every video that I shot in Tenerife last year that has been deleted off the SD card for 12 months. So I was actually staggered by how it managed to recover these files, but no sign of the one that I wanted. So the upshot of it was I didn't buy either of these pieces of software because they couldn't actually find the piece of footage that I wanted. And there's a slight criticism with both of these. They both play the same game. There's a lot of the word use of the word free on their website. Free download, free this, free that. Now, of course, you do download the software for free, and it does scan your SD card for free. Then it gives you the thumbnails of all the files that you've had deleted. And when you try to recover them, bang, that's when they hit you with the payment screen. And even the most basic version was something like $69 or $67. So in the end, I didn't end up paying. But I think that their wording on their website could be a little less clickbaity, because everybody's going in thinking, oh, I'm going to get a free trial here. But actually, no, they're going to tell you what files you want, and then they're going to make you pay for them. They don't even let you do one or two as a test, which I think is a bit naff. So the upshot of it was, Pascal, is the following day I had to go back to Athelstaneford or Aylshingford and reshoot that key pivotal scene. The good news is the weather was just as good, the light was just as good, and I managed to stand in exactly the same place and probably did a better second take in the end anyway. But it was interesting that it led me to these file recovery softwares.
No, absolutely. And it's happened to all of us. Thank you very much. And delighted, not only that you managed to record it, but that the weather condition was the same, because within a millisecond of you saying you went back for a second shot, the filmmaker in me went, oh, God, I hope that the continuity is going to be just right. We were wearing the same clothes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Same clothes, same hat. And I got the same sort of framing and everything in. I guess you'll probably be able to tell the difference. I think the sky was slightly less blue the second day, but I did do some color correction in Premiere Pro to try and make it look the same.
Can't wait to see the results. So for me, this is actually the result of an interesting conversation I've had with clients where, of course, people are doing more things internally. They are still using the services of graphic designers, video editors, copywriters, and so on. But occasionally, you have to move a bit faster or it makes sense to do it online. So I was doing a bit of coaching on how to organize your online workspace, Roger, so you know that all too well. Your finding system, everything has to be done in such a way that you don't waste time looking for the file, so it's not been deleted, the file that you need because the naming has been correct, because the hierarchy of your folders from the sound files, from the video, from the media assets, and so on. And this is when I discovered that they didn't have a lot of what I would call media assets and additional kind of content for themselves, you know, whether you use Canva or Premiere Pro or even Wondershare, who are for editing software, you have to have up your sleeve, as you do, your lower thirds, your animations, your closing, opening credits, and that kind of things. So actually, at the same time, which has been interesting right now with my inbox, received an email from a company I didn't know. So I don't know where they got my email address, but all is forgiven because actually they provide a very good service for free and chargeable copyright-free assets, music, visual effects, 3D animations, graphics, and more. And they have a lovely name of Production Crate. So, and that's what it is. So you literally, you open your kind of wooden crate and you find things inside. That's kind of the imagery that comes to mind. And it's very well organized. Really, there's a plethora of video and media assets for your next project. You can try the free elements. And of course, the chargeable one, which takes you to 4K and more, are better or could be what you're looking for. But they have a membership system, very much like the Envato elements that you know as well, that could be worth your while as an organization. And then I came across another one, which is more perhaps for content creators in the form of graphics and logos, icons, to do mock-ups and so on. So they have, again, a fantastic name of Graphic Ghost. So you go on graphicghost.com, and there you have free and premium illustrations, logos, vectors, icons, more that type of web-based experience, and mock-ups and more. So I think for me, the message is, get yourself ready, have around you your digital assistant, by all means, you know, the video editors, the AI, and so on. But you have to plan in advance. And that's probably the message that you shared already. You know, look ahead a bit more and start to compile and gather, you know, what you will need for the future, not the day of the when the job is needed.
Oh, this is really good. I mean, I, as you know, have looked at quite a lot of these things, like the aforementioned Envato elements. Motion Bro do a really good collection of things that you can use, visual effects, graphics, templates, and that sort of thing. But always on the lookout for new things, because let's face it, it's a bit like using something like Epidemic Sound. I'll go through Epidemic Sound, I'll pick a piece of music for a video, and I'll upload that video, and then I'm watching some other YouTuber, and oh my goodness, they use the same music as I do. So sometimes it's worth spreading your wings a little bit further out so you can find something that's just a little bit different.
That's excellent. Roger Edwards, viewers and listeners, we have reached the last segment of Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast, Film Marketing, just after this. We're going back to the year 2000. And probably what is still to this day the greatest historical action movie of all times, Gladiator. Let's watch the trailer.
Remove your helmet and tell me your name.
My name is Gladiator. Father to a murdered son. Husband to a murdered wife. And I will have my vengeance.
Today I saw a slave become more powerful than the Emperor of Rome.
They said you were a giant. I shall cheer for you.
At my signal, unleash hell.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
Oh, Pascal, what a film. What a film.
As I mentioned in the introduction, only days ago, I've added Gladiator into the watch list for Amazon Prime. And I'm so looking forward to it because I've got the memory of having an amazing time at the cinema because it's quite an experience. But also the lead up is interesting. We'll talk about the marketing, but of course, owning the VHS, owning the DVD, and owning the Blu-ray with all the extras and so on and so forth. But for me, Gladiator, it was one of those where I felt like I was being well looked after as a movie fan, as part of an audience. But also, it was for everyone, albeit that it was, of course, a dark and brutal movie, so not for young children. But ultimately, all ages went to see movies like I used to with my grandparents and my parents in the 60s when we went to see movies such as Spartacus and many others.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got everything in it. It's got drama, it's got action, it's got great acting, you know, romance and relationships and history, everything merged together. And yeah, I've got the 4K Blu-ray, and I think we'll probably watch it tomorrow. Interestingly enough, the 4K Blu-ray has the extended version, I think the original DVD that was launched years and years ago had a load of deleted scenes on it that you could watch separately. But they actually realized that even the deleted scenes were remarkably good. You know, sometimes you get a DVD and you'll think, I know why they deleted that scene, because it's rubbish. But all these deleted scenes are absolutely great. So they actually have put them all into the actual movie for the extended cut. So that's worth watching if you've got it. But, I mean, this film is... it's quotable, isn't it? There are lines from this film that a lot of people would be able to say without even looking it up. You know, things like, at my signal, unleash hell, and what we do in life echoes in eternity. And my favourite is that line when Commodus makes him take his helmet off, so the Spaniard reveals himself and he goes, my name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the north, general of the Felix legions, and loyal servant to the true emperor Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next. I mean, I've just got shivers down my spine reading out. And when you watch the film, when he says those lines, I mean, that's, to me, that's one of the best lines in cinema history. You just can't help but feel the power of it. And the film has got many moments like that.
The film was also a breakthrough for me with regard to, again, you know, the experience whereby where you were in different environments. So when you were in what would be now Germany, when you were in Rome and so on, the color palette changed and the texture changed, everything changed. But the music as well from Hans Zimmer. As soon as you hear the first few notes, some of the probably three or four tracks that people know by heart, including the closing credits track, it literally pulls on your heartstrings. But for me was also, and they used that in marketing a lot, was early CGI. Twofold, creating the world. So, you know, when you watch the extras, and I think it was my memory fails me whether it was part of the marketing leading up to seeing the movie was after, but where they were saying, well, we only design a bit of the Colosseum and the rest is filled in by CGI, including the people. But also, very, very, very sadly, Oliver Reed passed away before commission of the film. Yep. And that I knew was in the news that they used CGI to add into some of the scenes. And we were quite worried that it would not work, that we would see through it, because this was a year after The Phantom Menace, and there was some criticism of the use of CGI in The Phantom Menace. But I have to say that this worked for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's remarkable that this is 20-odd years ago that they did such a good job. I mean, we finally got round to watching the latest Indiana Jones film, and there were a few moments where they had the CGI version of Indiana Jones as the younger Indiana Jones. And I thought, oh, it's obvious that that's CGI. Whereas I don't remember feeling at any point in Gladiator that this, I'm looking at a CGI version of Oliver Reed. So that's remarkable given how long ago that was.
So you did the research for the marketing, and I'm with you. You know, my memory is kind of fluid because is it I'm remembering the extras? Am I remembering the press reaction after the movie was released and so on? But certainly, what I have literally in my mind, and that would be forever, is to begin with, is the poster of Gladiator.
Yeah, I mean, I think from looking back, we are probably remembering a lot of the extras that we got that came after on the DVD, and we're thinking that maybe there was those were part of the marketing. There were a lot of TV spots, and we'll come up to those. And of course, there was a lot of chat shows and a lot of appearances by the different actors across the plot. But you know, on this show, on Two Geeks and the Marketing Podcast, we've reviewed quite a lot of films where the marketing has focused in on individual posters for individual characters, like the Death on the Nile and that sort of thing, and Operation Fortune, where they give each character its own poster, and each character has maybe its own cards and space on the website. This would have been such a good film to have tried that, wouldn't it? You could have had a Maximus poster, you could have a Commodus poster, you could have had all the characters could have had their own posters. But what they went for in the end was utter simplicity itself, just one very striking picture of Russell Crowe holding a sword with the background of the sort of the walls of the Colosseum behind him, and that's pretty much it. But even in that image, you get a feeling for what the film's about and the power of the film and the storytelling, etc. You know, even if you look deeper at the breastplate that he has on his armor with the horses and the trees and the angel, it gives you a lot of insight into parts of the story. But to me, that is simplicity personified, that poster.
What is lovely about posters is they've gone for the geotone. It's almost like sepia looking to convey the feeling about, you know, the dirt, the sun, everything else like that. Actually, that takes me back to some of the negative reviews. There are a handful where people say, oh, this movie is too dark. And they meant in terms of tone, as in it's too dark, it's brutal and whatever. But also some of the imagery is too dark and I couldn't see what was happening. I'm thinking, perhaps we've not seen the same movie whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
Granted, it's dark within journey because it's early morning. Well, what are you going to do about it? You know, so I think there was some elements where people were a bit purist about criticizing Gladiator, saying, well, no, but Spartacus was better, or, you know, that the good old days of 60s and 70s movies. I said, well, which each generation and each kind of the evolution of cinema and with, you know, with each storyteller, we must be allowed to revisit historical events, you know, where that combines fiction and facts, of course. And I don't think Gladiator is a bad movie. I don't think it's certainly so dark that you can't see, you know, what the scenes are all about.
No, and it was massive success as well. You know, it earned $34.8 million in its opening weekend. You know, absolutely incredible. And it was up against some pretty stiff competition: Scream 3, Air Force One, Interview with a Vampire, which we've also spoken about on the show. And interestingly enough, even though the marketing wasn't as deep maybe as I think I remembered it, there was definitely a lot of word of mouth going on here. Now, obviously, at the time, Russell Crowe was a pretty... he had a lot of sex appeal, didn't he? He was rugged. He had that incredible personality and that presence. And apparently, word of mouth was one of the ways that the female audience for this film built up. You know, women went to see it, and it increased. The longer the film went was out, the more women went to see it, purely because of Russell Crowe's charisma and obviously the way he looked in the film.
I think that's important because, you know, when you take the marketing view, you look at audiences, segmentations and targeting and so on. And it's understandable people could say, no, it's a fighting film. It's a film that people killing each other you know, in an arena, why would I want to see that? But actually, Gladiator is so much more than that. And people know this now. And that's what's been voted by so many kind of magazines and you know, movie channels as one of the top films of all times. What I thought was interesting to, you know, reflecting 23 years later was if you look closely at the poster, there is a reference to a website, gladiator-thefilm.com. which I was able to rediscover thanks to the Wayback Machine, this great platform where you can enter your URL, and I'm guessing they can find copies of websites on someone's server. And when you look at the website, and we might even put a hyperlink in the show notes, Roger, honestly, it's so nostalgic because it's a flash website. Oh, yes, these were the days. You can watch a trailer, but it's a QuickTime player. So if you were probably on the PC, you can see a lot of it. But more importantly, however, for 2000, it's an interactive website. So actually, you are given options. You could go and become a gladiator and earn virtue points to discover more insight into the film. Or you can go straight into production and you can go into the arena and discover more about the life of gladiators. So there's something educational. And so it goes on. So a lot of thought, actually, for this website. I can tell you that certainly the website was accompanied with banner ads. Remember those days of the banner ads on websites like, you know, Yahoo or even any news websites? And you can tell that design skills have moved on quite a bit since 2000. So again, you look at those, it's quite charming and really quite delightful to see the evolution. But the principle of using banner adverts targeting film audiences by showcasing particular elements of the film and having a full interactive website. And you and I have said this time and time again on this show, it is a mystery to me why you would not want to have, you know, gladiator-thefilm.com still live for you and I and the fans to continue to visit.
No, it's absolutely right. I guess that at the time, they just didn't think that the future generations will be interested in it. What they also did, I mean, maybe this was instead of doing the character posters, which I think they could have done for this film, they did a whole series of TV spots, Pascal. I found at least 20 on YouTube. I didn't include the links to all of them. I just chosen one of my favorites, which I've put in the show notes. But 20 TV spots of about 30 seconds each. I guess each one focuses more on a specific character or more likely on a specific piece of dialogue. Now, one of the things I wanted us to talk about today is because this film is now generally regarded as one of the greatest movies of all time, one of the greatest action movies of all time, one of the greatest historical epic films ever made. And as you say, it's in that league of films like Spartacus and Quo Vadis and the Fall of the Roman Empire, is that they are going to make a sequel. Now, I'm a little bit worried about this, Pascal, because the bar is already about as high as it can possibly get, yes. You know, and how on earth can the sequel film live up to the original? And let's face it, 20 years have gone by now. And secondly, how on earth are you going to market that film knowing the shadow that it's sitting in, cast by the original film? Now, in fairness, they've been discussing a sequel for over 20 years. I think in the early days, there was even talk of Russell Crowe coming back as Maximus, and they were thinking of different ways of having him resurrected. You know, there was even a sort of religious, could he be resurrected in the same way as Jesus was? I think, my goodness, if they'd have gone down that route, it would have been quite laughable. I'm glad that that probably didn't plan out. And obviously, Russell Crowe doesn't look as good on the eye today as he did 20-odd years ago, and he won't be in the sequel. We're hearing names like Chris Hemsworth bandied about, and David Scarpa, etc., has written the script. I think it's going to focus on Lucius, who was the child, effectively the son of Maximus. I mean, they didn't sort of say it explicitly in the film, but the implication was there that Maximus had an affair with the emperor's daughter years ago, and that Lucius was his son. I don't think they said it explicitly in the film, but it is there. And I think that the new film will focus on his story about how he rises to become whatever, the gladiator, the emperor. But Pascal, would you like to be the marketing director of this film, knowing the how high the bar is and how much you're going to have to do to live up to the original?
Certainly, if I was given the job, I would be nervous, would be trepidation, but also because of the history of sequels. Let's be honest with you, they are few and far between. I mean, we've reviewed quite a few on this show, but also I think the only one that we agreed worked was Mad Max Fury Road. All the others, we talked about Blade Runner 2049 and all the others, we found, actually the marketing was pretty good, but unfortunately the audience just didn't have an appetite for it. And I think that's it, isn't it? If you take it back to, black and white Cartesian way of thinking about sales and marketing, do we have interest for such a product? I don't know. Personally, I do not. And that's going to be, as blunt as that. Do we have, however, the means to create something amazing? Yes, they do. So now you're in the business of creating demand for something that people have not asked for. And there are ways and means to do that. And of course, nowadays, there are more tools that you can add, to your toolkit. But I think it's a tough one because the formula that you mentioned, which was Russell Crowe, as a lead in, plus all the supporting cast, you had the novelty factor of this was gigantic. This was, a vast movie. It was an incredible experience, at the cinema. You had the early days of CGI. All this is behind us now. People have seen bigger and better almost since then. So all they're left with then is the emotional journey you can take the audience in by having a compelling story and characters you're going to get behind. And you've got to love to hate the villains. You've got to love to love, the goodies, to use, a very simplistic term. As far as I've seen so far, and this is all it is because this movie has just started filming, won't be out before winter 2024, there is nobody I feel I can get behind, and there's nobody that I'm going to be that invested to hating so they get that comeuppance.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, if they had, maybe they should have made a film inspired by Gladiator or something like that, but told a completely different story. But making it a sequel seems to me that they're setting themselves up for people to be disappointed. And I think that would be a shame because it will have an effect on the legacy of the original Gladiator. If they stuff up the sequel, then it will be associated with the greatest film of all time, perhaps. And I don't really want that negative connotation to happen.
No, and listen, Roger and I, we want, to be clear to our viewers and listeners, we want them to do well. We want to see another historical adventure that's going to really be so exciting and thrilling and so on. But I'm still recovering from a disappointment of the Star Wars sequels. Understand that. So, I can't cope with the second one, one of my beloved, movies. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us for another recording of Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast, and in particular for listening to this film marketing review of Gladiator, a film produced and released in 2000, chosen by Roger Edwards. Thank you so much for being a great co-host. All of you, please send your comments, reviews, and suggestions in usual places. Until the next time, go out there and make sure your marketing is done right. I was Pascal Pintoni, and he was Roger Edwards.